May it please the court, my name is Marvin Menaker from Dallas, Texas. I represent Finus and Flora Crawford. This case has to do with the proper construction of Article 21-23 of the Insurance Code and the effect of at least one decision of this court in recent times. Essentially, Article 21-23 says that a murderer cannot benefit in terms of life insurance by his or her act. The court goes, statute goes on to say that where there is a murder involved, that the nearest relative of the insured shall receive the insurance. Rather simple on its face, and in this case, it is undisputed that Flora and Finus Crawford are the nearest relatives. Let me set the background very briefly. Cornelia Schoaf was married to Sandra Schoaf. They had no children. Cornelius Schoaf had a child by a previous marriage by the name of Cornell. In May of 1979, Cornelius murdered Sandra. The trial court and jury found that it was willful. Therefore, Cornelius is disqualified under the statute. The problem then comes about, what is the proper distribution of the insurance proceeds? There were four policies. Two of them are not in issue. Under two of them, the intent and the beneficiaries were clear, and there is no appeal to this court about those two. But two of them leave some problems for us. The trial court and the Court of Civil Appeals found that the son of Cornelius should take. They found that there was an exception to the 21-23 based upon this court's finding in Devereaux versus Nelson. Let me briefly discuss the two policies. The first one is what is called the Metropolitan Policy. The Court of Civil Appeals found, and we agree, that under that policy, which belonged to Cornelius because he was an employee of, I think it was of the state, that he controlled it, and there was no way under that policy that Sandra could have designated any kind of a contingent beneficiary. There just wasn't any way she could do it. The second policy, is the equitable policy. Under that policy, there was in that plan what is called a family plan of insurance. And under that family plan of insurance, Cornelius designated his wife as the beneficiary, and if not living, as contingent beneficiary, his brother Curtis. Interesting that he did not designate his son, but that's the way it is. Then, as to the portion of the policy that covered the life of Sandra, it is possible, I think, if you read the convoluted language of that policy clearly, there is ultimately a place in the policy that says special instructions. And it would have been possible, I believe, quite frankly, that she could have designated somebody in there. But whether you think it was her burden to understand that policy or not, the fact is that neither in the equitable policy or in the metropolitan policy did Sandra make any affirmative designation as to who she wanted the money to go to in the event that her husband was disqualified. We say that under the circumstances where Cornelius is disqualified because of the murder, it goes to her nearest relatives. She was the insured. The courts below have both said, no, it goes down his line, and it goes to Cornell. That, of course, requires that we analyze what this court held in Devereaux versus Nelson. It's a 1975 case. There was a dissent. But Devereaux says, and Devereaux is a situation, if I may digress for just a moment, Devereaux is a situation where a son, an adopted son, was given the proceeds of insurance policy, one policy, even though there was a natural son. The argument there was whether or not the money gets split between the two sons, adopted son and natural son, or whether the adopted son takes everything. This court held that the adopted son took everything. I do want to point out that in this case, there was a named contingent beneficiary that the murdered father or adopting father had expressly named this son. And he was a natural object of the bounty of the father. And there was an affirmative designation in the policy. In making the decision, the court referred with approval to the Williams case. Now, the Williams case is a slightly different kind of a situation. In Williams, there was a policy that said that the wife, if living, will receive, if not, contingent beneficiary, and again, an affirmative designation of a nearest relative that the son would take. There was a divorce in the Williams case, and the ex-wife murdered the insured, and there was an issue as to whether or not it goes to the son or to the estate. In the Williams case, approved by this court, it was found that the intent of the insured should be carried out. More specifically, this court held that the construction of the statute should be to effectuate the obvious intent of the insured. The court below said that there was an obvious intent and that the Cornell should get it. We respectfully disagree. If I may point out, both of the cases in the line which engraft, I guess what you would call an exception to 2123, are cases where there was an affirmative designation. In both of those cases, the recipient of the insurance money was a natural object of the affections of the murdered person. This case is not like that. In this case, it is our view that the only item that really goes the way of Cornell and his mother is that that child is doubtless guiltless. There is certainly no corruption of the blood that could be, shouldn't be, and we agree as to that point. But in this case, Cornell was not a designated beneficiary, as were the people in both Devereaux and Williams. Cornell is not the nearest relative, as were the persons in Devereaux and Williams. And Cornell is not the obvious object of the affections of the deceased. The parents, on the other hand, again, are not the designated beneficiary. There is no affirmative designation in the two policies, but they are the nearest relatives as set out in the statute. And they are, because they are the nearest relatives and the mother and the father, that they are within the intent of the statute to receive the proceeds of that insurance. To uphold the court below, we think would vitiate the intent of 2123. The nearest relative would not receive the insurance proceeds. And in this case, again, they differ from the two cited cases because here Cornelius controlled the policy, not the victim. Therefore, the decision below would destroy the plain statutory language and would deny the deceased the protection of the statute that the legislature enacted for the benefit of murder victims. It ignores the intent of the statute and of the victim. To award the policies down his bloodline does not carry out the intent of the legislature. We therefore have requested this court to reverse the court below and to render a decision for Finest and Flora Crawford.
Thank you, counsel, for a very good presentation.
May it please the court, Mr. Gerald Wolf will present arguments for the respondent.
Wolf.
May it please the court. Petitioner is asking this court to interpret Article 2123, the two sentences of Article 2123, by having this court create an exception as to when the second sentence of that statute should come into effect. The petitioner set out the first sentence of Article 2123 prohibits the individual who is willfully taking the life of the insured from collecting the proceeds of any life insurance. The question then is, when should the second sentence of Article 2123 come into effect? Petitioner has taken the position that the Devereaux case says that the second sentence will not come into effect unless you have two criteria. The first being that we have a contingent beneficiary that's specifically named in the policy, and that contingent beneficiary is an object of the obvious intent of the insurer. I think the petitioner is incorrect in its interpretation of the Devereaux case. I've read the Devereaux case and reread it several times, both this court's opinion and the opinion of the Court of Appeals. And I don't find in there any intention on part of this court to create an exception. I think what the court has done is created a very strict order of precedence as to whether and to when the second sentence of Article 2123 should come into effect. What this court has held is that before the proceeds of the insurance policy shall go to the contingent beneficiary, court or the trial court should look at the policy and should exhaust all beneficiaries, that is both contingent and primary beneficiaries. And then at that point, if there are no primary contingent beneficiaries who can take the proceeds of the insurance policy, the proceeds should go to the nearest relative rather than revert to the insured's estate and be subject to his debts and liabilities. The petitioner has made several references to what occurred in the trial court and what the trial court did, and I want to just clarify some of that. There were originally four insurance policies. There are only two policies that are now presented to this court. But the other two policies, the trial court made a decision not based upon, as petitioner would have you believe, that they followed the lines through the next of kin, the nearest relative. But rather, the trial court went to the individual insurance policy, read those policies, read the contingent beneficiary provisions of those policies, and based upon what the contingent beneficiary provision said, awarded those policies, one of those policies, to the parents because that was the next contingent beneficiary, and one of those policies to the deceased, Sandra Schultz, estate, which was the next contingent beneficiary. In the two policies that are before the court here, I don't really think there's any the petitioner's arguing about this, but in the two policies that are before the court here, The trial court read the contingent beneficiaries in those policies and made a determination based upon the contingent beneficiary provisions that the proceeds from those two policies should go to Cornell Show, because in the Metropolitan policy and in the Equitable policy, that child, as defined by the terms and conditions of those particular policies, he was the next contingent beneficiary. And he makes a lot of issue over the fact that in the Metropolitan policy, because that policy was owned by Cornelia Shelf, the murderer, that Sandra Shelf had no right, no legal right, to change that beneficiary provision. I don't think that that, in an actual practical sense, would really be the case. She knew that that policy was in existence. She signed the application to that policy, which would have to lead the court to believe that if she disagreed in some way with what the contingent beneficiary provisions were, she could have asked her husband to please designate some specific contingent beneficiaries. And along those lines, in none of the four policies, in any of the four policies that were before the trial court, did Sandra Show specifically designate her parents. It only, in the two policies that were awarded to her parents, it was only because the court concluded, the trial court concluded, that they were the next contingent beneficiaries. She didn't designate, she didn't change any of the contingent beneficiary provisions in any of the policies, which would again lead you to believe that she was in agreement with what those contingent beneficiary provisions contained. Additionally, in the Equitable policy, there was a specific provision that created the policy under the family plan rider that insured both her and Cornell. Both of those people, both her life and Cornell's life, were insured under that policy. And in the application for that family provision, Sandra Soap signed that application. And in that application, she specifically designated her husband as the primary beneficiary. And underneath that specific designation is the printed designation that in the event he's not alive, the contingent beneficiary would be child, and child as defined by the terms and conditions of that policy meant Cornell Warren Show.
Are you talking about the Equitable policy now?
Yes, I am.
I'm looking at the application for the Equitable policy, and under one it says proposed insured is Sandra. Four, beneficiary, says the insured's husband, Cornelius Show. And there's no contingent beneficiary listed, but then the language under beneficiary, the printed language, unless otherwise specified above, the contingent beneficiary will be the surviving children of the insured in equal shares, or if none survive, the insured's estate. Now, how do you read that to include Cornell?
If you go back into the policy, the definition of child in that Equitable policy, and I don't know if I have the specific wording in front of me, Your Honor, but in the specific wording says, defines child as being a stepchild. And Cornell Shelf was obviously a stepchild.
Yeah. And I don't have that in regards to the Equitable policy, but apparently the Metropolitan policy, in respect to alternate or contingent beneficiary, does define child as a stepchild, but one in a child-parent relationship. Now, is there any argument here as to whether or not Cornell was in a child-parent relationship with Sandra since Cornell lived with his mother?
I don't believe there is, Your Honor. I think that under the Equitable policy that there is a definition of child, and you have to use two different sections of the policy to determine it, but it defines child
as surviving stepchildren who are or have been insured family members.
Right. And Cornell Shelf was in fact listed in the application as an insured family member. on the application. That application was signed by Sandra. And Cornell Shelf is listed as an insured family member. I think that in the application it lists the spouse and the children, and both of them are listed as insured family members. And then, and that application is signed by Sandra.
So what we're really arguing about in this case is whether or not the plain language of Article 2123 controls over the language in the insurance policies. Is that what the argument boils down to?
Basically, Your Honor, or whether or not the Devereaux case creates this exception that says that you don't follow the second sentence if you have a named beneficiary versus a specifically named beneficiary and someone who is not the object of the intent. And there's a big question in my mind about intent, because I believe it was in the Franklin case where the court said that it would be an exercise in futility to try to determine what the intent of the insured would be if she knew that her husband was going to kill her, as far as who would be the contingent beneficiaries. There's no way especially in our case, Sandra Schoaf did not formulate that intent. And for this court or any trial court to try to spend a lot of time trying to determine what her intent would be under those circumstances is meaningless. I think a better way to deal with that particular problem would be to deal with it as if we had a simultaneous death. That is, at the moment that her husband killed her, he forfeited his rights to be a beneficiary under that policy. Now, what would Sandra Shelb's intent be as to who is going to take, as a contingent beneficiary, or who is going to take the benefits of that policy if both she and her husband died at the same time? That would be the only kind of intent she could possibly have had when these insurance policies were taken out. In that instance, I think we can look back to the policies and determine that she read these policies, she signed the application form, and one of the policies she specifically designated her husband and read the provision that set out the contingent beneficiary, that there is some evidence that she intended that the contingent beneficiary in the case of a simultaneous death should be Cornell Show. And we can likewise assume in the other two policies that were awarded to her by the trial court that she assumed and intended that in case of a simultaneous death on those two policies, the contingent beneficiary should be her parents or her estate. To try to spend a lot of time and have a trial court have a hearing on what would be her intent if she knew that her husband was going to kill her would be almost impossible. Because obviously she never formed or never had such an intent. One additional point I'd like to point out is that petitioner makes a great deal of argument with regard to whether or not awarding the proceeds of the insurance policy to the contingent beneficiary is in violation of the interpretation of the statute. I don't think it does. The rules of construction say that we have to interpret a statute as it's on its whole. Here, the intent of the statute was to forfeit the right of the killer, of the murderer, and see that he doesn't benefit from anything that was wrong, and that's done by allowing the contingent beneficiary to take the proceeds. If there was no contingent beneficiary, then the statute itself would take the proceeds and give them to the nearest relative rather than allowing them to go to the estate. So I don't think that allowing the secondary contingent beneficiary to receive the proceeds from the life insurance policy does any violence to interpretation of the statute, and in fact is in conformity with it.
Have you thought about the expression in Devereaux, obvious intent? Do you think that is true here?
Judge, I don't believe there is the word obvious intent in the Devereaux case. There is the word intent is used. And I think that there is some evidence of the intent of Sandra Shove to give these policies or the proceeds of these policies as a contingent beneficiary to Cornell Show. Again, there is no evidence that she intended or made any specific designation to her parents.
The term obvious intent is used in Devereux.
I'm sorry.
Obvious intent.
There is no evidence presented in the trial court as to what her intent was. Neither Cornelia Shelf testified as to what her intent was, nor did was she able to testify, or anybody else testify as to what her intent was upon the taking out of these policies. We can only look to what's there and written in the policies. And if she signed those application forms, and in one policy, in the Equitable policy, specifically designated her husband, we knew that by the fact that she did that, that she knew how to change a beneficiary form. She had the ability to do it. She could have, as she wrote out, that the primary beneficiary is going to be her husband. If she so desired to make her parents the contingent beneficiary, she could have done so at that time and did not do it. And I think the fact that she didn't do it would lead us to believe that she was in agreement with what was printed in the insurance policy as far as what the contingent beneficiary is. I think in addition to that, to allow contingent beneficiaries or people who are unhappy with who the contingent beneficiary is in insurance policy to come back behind the written specific provisions in the contingent in the insurance policy after the primary beneficiary has been disqualified for some reason would really create havoc with the courts. It would create a lot of uncertainty in insurance policies. It would open a lot of gates to further litigation, and would put an impossible burden on the court to try to determine what the insured's intent was. I think we have to look to what the insured did in the insurance policy, what's written in the insurance policy, and what the facts show, what the four corners of the policy show.
Let me back up just a moment and ask you a question that I'm really not clear on. Is it your contention that the policy controls over Article 2123, which says that when such is the case, the nearest relative of the insured shall receive the proceeds?
It's my contention because I think that's what the holding is in this court in Devereux. I think that this court in Devereux specifically said that before we will allow the proceeds to go to the nearest relative, we must exhaust all. And in the court's opinion, the word all is in italics. All beneficiaries, primary and contingent. And I think that that's what the holding is that yes, we're going to go to the nearest relative rather than to the estate, but only after we've exhausted the primary beneficiaries and contingent beneficiaries. And then if no one's found to take under that policy, rather than allow the proceeds to go to the estate, we're going to send them to the nearest relative. And I believe that's what the holding of this court is in the Devereux case.
Devereux seems to predicate its holding by saying such construction not only effectuates the obvious intent of the insured, then it goes on. So the Devereux court does place a great emphasis on the obvious intent of the insured.
And I agree.
You're suggesting that the obvious intent here is that the stepson received proceeds?
Based on the fact that before the court, yes I am, because there is no intent that she intended otherwise. There's no designation as of a parent. She had an opportunity to do so. There's no testimony that that was her intent. And in fact, there's evidence the other ways that she had the opportunity, had she wanted to designate, and did not do so.
One thing in the Court of Appeals opinion that troubles me, Mr. Wolf, in regards to the Equitable policy, and I'm reading from page 84 of that opinion, says that Cornelius was the insured under the Equitable policy, and Sandra was the insured spouse. And it seems to imply that because they find Cornelius to be the insured, that therefore Carnell, as the surviving child of Cornelius, would take. Is that the construction that you got out of the Court of Appeals opinion?
I'm not sure about
it. It's under keynote four.
Middle paragraph.
I don't have the printed opinion. I just have the
you got the slip of pen in there? Okay.
Who do you contend is the insured under the equitable policy?
I'm sorry?
Who is the insured? Sandra or Cornelia?
Sandra. She's designated as the insured.
Okay. Then if she is, the nearest relative of the insured shall receive the insurance, is the way the statute reads.
That's correct.
And the only exception to that is the Devereux exception.
Which says that you have to exhaust both contingent and primary beneficiaries before you go to the nearest relative. And I believe that by reading the equitable policy, that if you look at that policy and use the words that are defined in that policy with regard to child, that Cornell Show is the child that's defined in that policy. I don't think there's any contention on the part of petition that that's not the case. I think they agree that the wording and the definition of the policy would make Cornell Show the contingent beneficiary. And that was the basis that the trial court ruled.
What would a holding like that do to this statute?
I think that's the way the Devereux case holds the statute right now.
Right. But Devereux is rather tight holding. It uses the obvious intent. And do you think this opens a wider door of exceptions than Devereux?
No, I think this narrows the Devereux exception. And it says that the trial court, I guess, should look to the policy to determine what the other contingent beneficiaries are. And I think just the fact that there's another contingent beneficiary in the policy shows some intent on the part of the insured to name a contingent beneficiary.
So some intent or obvious intent, is there a difference?
There is a difference, Your Honor. And I'm not certain whether how much intent is obvious intent. Here there isn't any evidence as to what obvious intent was, so the only thing we can do is look to what is there in the policy and what the parties could or could not have done when they were filling out the application for this insurance. I suppose one of the rulings of this court would be to send this case back and have a hearing at the trial court as to what her obvious intent was at the time. But I think we just get both sides of that.
Do you agree that Sandra was the insured in both these policies? Is there any question about that? Any contention otherwise, I guess I should ask.
No, she is the insured. I think the insured has, the word insured is a word of art in insurance. And as that word is interpreted by insurance law, I think she is the insured.
In other words, the person whose life activates the claim has got to be the insured.
That's correct.
Your death activates the claim, rather.
Pretty obvious she was the insurer to those two insurance companies. They wouldn't drop policies in the registrar's court.
Oh, yeah. But I still believe that under both of those policies, if you look to the definitions in those policies, which I think you're obligated to do, that Cornell Shelf becomes the contingent beneficiary by the policies and the definitions within the policies themselves.
Thank you, counsel.
Briefly, sir. Article 21-23 has two prongs. One is the forfeiture if there's a murder, which occurred. And the second one is that the nearest relative of the insured shall receive the insurance. There are two prongs, and the statute is, I assume, to be enforced by the court. This case, contrary to what counsel says, would open the door wide if you affirm. Because when the court wrote Devereux, it was saying, we are giving to the nearest relative, as the statute says, But we are determining, because there was an obvious intent, that this particular nearest relative gets. In both cases, there was a spouse who was disqualified, and the son who was the next nearest relative took. If you are to...
The Court of Appeals opinion says, since the policy gives the right to designate others than those specified as beneficiaries, it is proper to assume that Sandra intended for the proceeds to be paid as specified.
I respectfully disagree. The court did find expressly on the Court of Civil Appeals expressly found that she could not designate on the Metropolitan. So I think that removes that from that language. Where I disagree with their finding is on the equitable policy.
Yeah, that's what we're talking.
The difference is, I agree that it was conceivable that if you look in the appendix to our brief, that if under special instructions on that last page, if Sandra had said, made an affirmative designation, I think she could have done so, and I would not, you know, mislead the court. I think that it took a pretty good lawyer to follow that policy to come to that conclusion, but I think that she could have done so. But that, Judge Robertson, is contrary to what the statute says and to what this court did in Devereaux. Devereaux gave it to the nearest relative. Williams gave it to the nearest relative. And if we follow counsel's line of reasoning, you are now saying that we will, if there is a printed language in a contract that takes it out of the nearest relative, we'll ignore the statute and go to other people. I don't believe that is appropriate. The only thing I agree with counsel on in his argument is that obviously if someone has any inkling that they're going to be murdered, they act differently, among other things, on terms of insurance. Sandra, placed as she was, could have no possible inkling that she was making a beneficiary, a murderer, or someone else based upon those circumstances. I respectfully say to the court that the court should reverse and render, because that carries out both the intent of the statute and is consistent with the holding of this court in Devereaux, holding an affirmative designation is necessary if you're not going to go down the line under the statute, and even there they went to a nearest relative. And I thank you.
I believe we have some law students today from the University of Houston and South Texas School of Law. We're happy to have our young people in court. I hope that you've enjoyed yourself. That completes our business today.
Well,